Okay, we are live. Well, hello everyone. Thank you so much for coming today. I hope everyone is safe, healthy, well, all that good stuff. This is the first installment of our Spring AIMSES Digital Speaker Series, and we are delighted to have Dr. Sarah Pursley here today to talk about her book. Some of you, I think most of you know what AIMSES does. Some of you may be new. I know there's a few new people here. So I just thought I'd read our mission statement really quickly. So the Association of Middle East Children and Youth Studies, AIMSES, is a private, nonprofit, international association for scholars with an interest in the study of children and youth in the Middle East, North Africa, and their diaspora communities. Through interdisciplinary programs, publications, and services, AIMSES promotes innovative scholarship, facilitates global academic exchange, and enhances public understanding about Middle Eastern children and youth in diverse times and places. This spring series is a big part of that mission. This is our second season now. Nazan spoke last year, and Heidi gave an interview. I gave a few interviews. So this is our second season. If you have any ideas about potential speakers for spring 2022, please send an email to me. I just put my email in the chat there. We obviously do books, clearly, but we do articles, book chapters, edited volumes. We think all of it's important. Although this season we have some great speakers, they are all going to be books, which I don't think that's a problem. But in the future, I think it would be great to have some articles and book chapters and things along those lines as well. If you are not yet a member of AIMSES, I would say please consider joining. We don't think it's too steep of a membership price. And so we can keep offering great content like this, do prizes, generate more membership, whatever it may be. So the membership form is there, and you can send myself any questions. I am the program chair at AIMSES. I don't think I mentioned that. I got right to it. So yeah, my name's Dylan, for those who don't know me. And yes, I'm the program chair for AIMSES, and I teach Modern Middle East History at the University of Alabama in Huntsville. So just a few logistic things before we get started. If all audience members could just mute their mics, which it seems that's the case at this point, that'd be great. So we get a crisp feed. I think the more people whose cameras are on, the better. I think that'll be great for kind of the conversation to keep Tori and Sarah engaged for sure. And so it's a th we will Tori here in a second. I'll give the floor to Tori. We'll give a 30-minute interview, followed by a 30-minute question and answer. There's three ways to answer question to ask questions. You can just unmute your mic. We have a pretty small group here. A few other people may join, but it's pretty small. So I think you just unmute, introduce yourself, maybe turn on your video, that type of thing, and ask away. You can chat in your questions. So if you kind of think of things during the talk, you can definitely chat it in, and I'll take a look at those, and Tori will ask those questions. Or last but not least, you can just raise your hand. In the bottom right function, you'll see a reactions. There's all types of reactions, thumbs up if you like what you're hearing. But also you can raise your hand that way, and we can make sure that your question is answered that way. So I guess about it. I'm going to turn over the floor now to our interviewer for the day, who is Tori Brakowski. And Tori is a PhD candidate in sociocultural anthropology at UC Davis and our AIMSES graduate student representative. So Tori, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Dylan. And I want to extend a huge welcome to our audience and to Sarah Pursley for visiting us. I am speaking from Northern Arapaho land, just to start there. And I had the absolute honor and privilege of reading and reviewing this book by Sarah Pursley, Familiar Futures, which we will be discussing in detail today. I woke up this morning, however, to the news that once again another bombing had swept through eastern Syria in response to violence in Iraq. And so, as I've been thinking about how to start this conversation, it's reminded me that despite the fact that Sarah Pursley is a historian trained at CUNY and has been doing research on experiences of time, space, and selfhood in the region during the 20th century, that the larger questions of imperialism and colonialism, time, selfhood, both secular and Islamic, continue to influence the way that we understand not only the region, but also ourselves. Her book, Familiar Futures, looks at how various understandings of time and selfhood, as well as the pedagogical interventions that both the British and then the Americans, and then the Iraqi state introduced into the intimate lives of Iraqis in the name of economic development and anti-colonial revolution, shaped what came to count as experience itself. So to begin, I thought it would be really interesting to take us actually to Baghdad, not to begin in the sort of abstract frame of analysis from afar, but to begin in a place, in a specific time, which is, I'm gonna show you all. I can figure out how to do that. There we go. Which is this monument, which was commissioned by Abdul Karim Qasim, and I believe 1859, and it was made by Jodhat Salim, and I believe I spelled that wrong, I can fix that. And I'm wondering if we can start here, Sarah, if you can introduce the larger framing of your work in the context of these images and how they show us another way of thinking time and space. And as you speak, we'll move through at least two of the images, which are of children.
Okay, thanks so much, Tori, for the introduction. So I talk about this monument, which is a famous public work of art in Baghdad, which is still standing. I talk about it in the epilogue of the book as a way to kind of visualize some of the concepts and arguments I've been making throughout the book. I could say a lot about it. I do say a lot about it in the epilogue, and I've written about it elsewhere too. So I'm not going to say everything I could say about it. But, you know, the monument itself, you know, we are often told is to be read from right to left, like a line of, you know, of Arabic text, you know, through the nationalist movement that culminated in the revolution of 1958, depicted in the center panel, which is technically a military coup. So that's a soldier there right in the middle. And then ending in this peaceful, prosperous, and economically developed future on the far left. There are actually different ways of reading the monument that Iraqi art critics have been writing about for some time. You can start in the middle and go outward both directions simultaneously. You can start in the left. You could see the whole thing as the spoke of a wheel instead of a fixed horizontal line. You can read it as like an Ibn Khaldun story of nomads overthrowing a civilization and then developing through time, and then the whole thing repeats itself. So there are actually many ways of reading this monument in terms of its temporal structure, which is one of the things I talk about. But what I really want to focus on is these two images of children that appear in the monument. So one is the first one, which is, yeah, the slide number two. So this is the second scene of the monument. So the first scene is sort of these tribal nomads, possibly the 1920 uprising against the British occupation. And then these three figures come directly out of that, out of these four nomadic figures struggling with a rearing horse. Then we come to this, these three figures who, you know, generally seen as depicting the nationalist movement and probably in particular sort of the leftist communist subculture of the 1950s. It's a man, a woman, you know, sort of striding in unison, holding political placards in the air, those rectangular things above them. And then this child who sort of floats out from the monument. It's actually the only fully three-dimensional figure in the monument is this child figure. So, you know, we have here, you know, I mean, sort of the nuclear family model that many, you know, secular leftists and others saw as marking modernity, both as kind of a cause and effect of modernization. I mean, there are different ways of reading the scene, as with all the scenes. I mean, the guy was an artist, plus, you know, there are multiple ways of, you know, reading things in general. But what I want to do right now is just think about, so this child figure, you know, I see as, you know, maybe right now would be a way to sort of think about my title of the book, Familiar Futures, and the different kind of meanings I have in mind for that title. You know, if this is sort of the modern image of a family that many people had at the time. This is one of the first kind of register or meaning I have for the book's title, Familiar Futures, is the importance of familial life. So familiar as familial. It's the importance of family life, of certain ideas of gender, of certain ideas of age, of childhood, to kind of the future-oriented, you know, imaginaries of modernity. With this child in particular too, I use it to sort of illustrate a concept I look at throughout the book, which I draw from Lee Edelman, which is the concept of reproductive futurism. So in Edelman's argument, this child figure who becomes the kind of embodiment of the nation's future appears to be this forward-looking, future-oriented kind of discourse, but it ends up in all kinds of ways being used to justify sort of freezing time in the present or repeating time in this really static way. So, you know, we can't have X until we have, you know, development in the interest of the child is one of the things I look at. We can't have democracy until we have development. We can't have this until we have development. You know, this very familiar discourse of decolonizing countries as they were coming to be called developing countries in this period, and the ways in which that got overlaid with this global idea of the child as the embodiment of the nation's future. So in Edelman's argument, it's a child that never grows up and a future that never arrives, right? That's the problem with it. So it ends up like constantly being used in these arguments for deferral. And I could say more particular, I could give more particular examples if people are interested about specific things that were deferred in the name of this sort of imaginary receding future. That's one way to understand this scene. On the other hand, you know, this is a child who is possibly participating in this demonstration, right? The woman is participating in the demonstration. So this is not exactly, you know, bourgeois feminine domesticity, right? Most Iraqis at the time recognized this couple as like, you know, the leftist, you know, counterculture that was really important in Iraq at this time. And a lot of children, you know, actual children were participating in these protests, you know, in the revolutionary events. So there are different ways of reading this. You know, there's the more hegemonic way I just gave you, and then there's this more sort of heterotemporal ways. I draw on Deepesh Chakrabarty's notion of postcolonial heterotemporalities to kind of look at different ways that these figures were understood. So that's the floating child figure. And then if we go to the next one, this is a different child. On the left, this child is in its mother's arms. And the set of figures that come right before it is a corpse. It's the martyr. So it's a mother curled over the body of her martyred adult son, right? And then right after that is this woman cradling her newborn child. So these two figures modify the narrative's linear forward motion with these circular shapes, right? Referring to, you know, death and redemption and reproduction. And then the revolution itself comes directly out of this set of figures. You know, so the idea here, I think, is, you know, you can keep gunning us down as often as you want, but we're just going to keep putting up more of us, right? You can't actually stop the revolution. So it's a sort of idea of inevitability through this different idea of repetition or cyclical time than I was referring to with the previous scene. I mean, this is actually a more, I think, politically productive depiction of cyclical time, right? That actually leads to a revolution. So one of the things I do is kind of contrast these cyclical or repetitive ideas of time with this linear modernization theory of time in ways that are sort of counterintuitive, right? We think of cyclical time as not actually getting us anywhere, but in this case, it's exactly what does get the narrative somewhere because it allows for a more kind of more purchase on historical time. So I'm thinking about death and childhood and different ways of imagining generational time in relation to political change is one of the ways I use these two particular figures. So sorry for the super long answer there, but I'll pause there.
I mean, as a quick follow-up, Sarah, before I move on to the next question, I recall I was like five or very, very young when the US first started doing its military adventures in the Middle East. And at the time, no one in my immediate circle or family could explain to me why. And as I was reading your work, I still recall one of the statistics, and if we can go back to the placard, that there were 50,000 women out in the streets in Baghdad at the time. And I know you corrected that number later, but there it seems to strike me as such a problem in American knowledge, or at least in my knowledge of Iraq, which presumed that because of this, you know, developmentalist notion of progress, that America was democratic and Iraq was not. And yet your story and the story of the protests that we're looking at right here shows that since the 50s, it's been almost maybe the opposite. And I wonder if you could locate these images within that revolutionary moment before we continue.
Yeah, so this is, you know, it's a depiction of the, you know, the movement that led to the 1958 revolution, the women's wing of the Communist Party, which eventually just became the, I mean, even at the time, it was the feminist movement in Iraq. And eventually they split off from the Communist Party and it was called the League for the Defense of Women's Rights. Actually, it still exists. And it was huge. I mean, the organization itself claimed like 40,000 members. There's no way to really prove that because their documents were lost after the 63 coup. This demonstration itself was a few thousand. I mean, the demonstration I talk about in the opening of the book, I talk about a demonstration in Baghdad, this woman's group, wing of the Communist Party did, which was a few thousand people. So, but it was a big movement. I mean, it was, you know, the League for the Defense of Women's Rights was like a household name in Iraq. You know, I mean, people knew about it for sure. And it was very active. I mean, even you read the U.S. Department of State archives, you know, people in the Baghdad embassy are talking about it. You know, it was a really well-known organization and a really significant organization. In terms of the U.S., you know, the sort of discourse around the 2003 invasion, I think that is really important to my story. You know, I mean, my story ends in 1963, the book, but one thing I look at is how American advisors came to Iraq starting in the 1930s and as education advisors. I mean, they were invited by the government and they started criticizing the Iraqi education system for giving girls and boys the same education, which up until 1932, the official curriculum for girls and boys was the same for reasons I could go into. And these American advisors came in and said, no, you can't do that. You have to be teaching girls home economics, right? For a significant amount of time they spent in school, just like they were in the US. And the Iraqi government did that. They gradually differentiated the curriculum by sex through the 30s, 40s, and 50s in response partly to these suggestions of American advisors and then UN and World Bank and, you know, other kinds of international advisors. So the discourse kind of shifts, like almost turns upside down, is inverted by 2003, right? In 1932, when these Americans arrive, and even 1952 after when some more come from the UN, the idea is that Iraq is backwards because they're giving girls and boys the same education. Because at that point, for the US hegemonic idea was that to be modern, you have to be giving girls and boys different educations. So all girls in US public schools, you know, were required to take home economics. That was the case until it was banned by Title IX in 1972. So, you know, then it flips because of the second wave feminist movement in the US starts going after home economics as a required field of study. So by the time the US invades Iraq in 2003, the idea of modernity in the US is the opposite, right? Sexual equality is the marker of modernity. So now Iraq is backwards because they're treating, you know, men and women differently. Whereas in the 30s to the 50s, Iraq was backwards because they were treating men and women, at least in the schools, in too similar a way. So, you know, what has shifted here is American ideas of modernity in relation to gender. You know, the modernization discourse, the development and underdevelopment discourse, the place of gender as a really central marker of all of that, that's the same. But the American ideas of the relation of gender difference, sexual difference to modernity has been completely, almost completely inverted. So then 2003, you know, sexism, supposedly, you know, Iraqi misogyny, you know, the way Islam treats women, that's now a justification for the U.S. invasion. So it's almost an exact inversion of what the discourse was in the 30s of why the U.S. was, I mean, why these American advisors were in Iraq.
And that's what I was taught by my school, my elementary and middle school and high school about Iraq, is that the U.S. forces needed to be there to liberate women, right? That's exactly the discourse that's used. And it occurs to me that, you know, as this commission of U.S. educators from Teachers College, ironically, are going into Iraq, that many of the members of the commission had for several decades advocated for the export of decolonizing countries, a model of education developed actually in segregated schooling projects for Black youth in post-Reconstructionist South. And so I'm wondering, you know, as they're exporting, literally exporting this racialized difference mode of education, this mode of education based on racialized difference, they're also reproducing sexual difference. And is there, there seems to be a relation in the labeling of Iraq as backwards, first of all, and locating it behind America in progressivist time. But yeah, I'm wondering about the splitting of Iraq into modern and backwards within the conversations and research production of the commission itself.
Yeah, so this commission arrived. I mean, they were all professors at Columbia Teachers College, which was like the center of, you know, pragmatist forms of schooling in the U.S. John Dewey taught there until he retired in the late 20s. But Columbia Teachers College, you know, we think of it as, you know, the center of pragmatism and democratic forms of education and all this stuff. And it was, I mean, that was one, you know, really important strand of pragmatism, but it was also totally connected to the Hampton and Tuskegee Institutes in the South, you know, segregated schooling projects for Black youth in the South, which were about, it was called industrial education, which didn't mean industrial as in industrial labor. It meant manual labor. So promoting, you know, for kids, Black kids in the South were supposed to learn agricultural skills for manual labor because that was their lot in life. life, right? So this was the whole, you know, W.B. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington dispute, you know, all of that. But that gets, you know, one of these professors, for example, sat on the boards of both the teacher college where he taught and of the Hampton Institute, one of the guys that ends up in Iraq writing this report. And so they get to Iraq, and what they argue is, you know, they reproduce this racialized logic in Iraq, except now it's just urban and rural kids, right? So rural kids cannot be taught academic subjects. Rural youth need to learn manual agricultural labor, just like Black youth in the American South. And the Iraqi students actually went to teachers college. A bunch of them went there because there was an agreement between teachers college and the Iraqi government. Then they were sent to the South, to Hampton and Tuskegee, to learn these techniques. And then they go back to Iraq, and several of them become ministers of education, I mean, the directors of education in Iraq. And this whole model had a really important effect on the Iraqi school system. So basically they get to Iraq and they say, you need to teach girls and boys separate educations. So you need to differentiate the curriculum by sex, and you need to differentiate it by rural or urban location. So rural boys in particular learn agricultural skills. Girls, wherever they are, learn home economics. And then there's a small class of urban boys who can study academic subjects. That was the argument. And it was phrased in this pragmatist language of education for real life, right? But completely divorced of any sort of democratic impulse that was in pragmatism in the US, at least in certain parts of the US, right? I mean, this was, you know, it was replicating this uneven model of education in the US, this racial model to Iraq.
I think this is super important, especially now with Black Lives Matter, right? And this question of decolonizing education. And I'd like to take us back to the beginning of your book before we start concluding and opening it up for audience questions. You write that in 1929, as the British Mandate is really consolidating its power in Iraq, that there was an annual report written to the League of Nations, right? So a report about the progress of this place called Iraq, in which the Iraqi Ministry of Education's regulation banning the use of corporal punishment in secondary schools was critiqued. So in other words, the Iraqi Minister of Education wanted to stop corporal punishment, and the Brits were like, no, we need to keep hitting children and youth. Now, in this debate, you write that part of what was at stake was this category, a new category of differentiation of adolescence. And in particular, the troublemaking adolescence of the youth who were opposing not only Iraqi or not only British colonization, but also Zionist presence. So I'm wondering, what is this stage of adolescence serving for Iraq, British Mandate authorities? Why was it so concerning? And how are other ways of thinking about adolescence that you found in your work?
Yeah, so, you know, partly I'm, you know, drawing on Nancy Lesko and others who have looked at adolescence as a colonial category, right? I mean, adolescence sort of emerges globally in the early 20th century within the field of psychology initially, but already it's this racialized developmental category, right? I mean, the idea that some races, civilizations, nations, you know, it's phrased in different ways, were in a stage of childhood, some were in a stage of adolescence, and some were in a stage of adulthood. This adolescence part was new. You know, the childhood thing is a colonial category that goes way back, but this adolescence was new in the early 20th century as this period of political, psychological, social chaos, right, that needs to be managed and regulated in various ways. It becomes really important to the League of Nations mandate system, right, because the African nations were declared in a state of childhood, the Middle Eastern nations were considered in a stage of adolescence. I mean, that was the explicit discourse around the mandate A, B, and C categories. And of course, Iraq was one of those mandates. So Iraq was in an adolescent category of development. So it's a colonial category that gets used, you know, it's metaphorically, you know, gets used both for the nation and the individual. But these things are connected everywhere that this concept of adolescence is being developed, including in the field of psychology in the US. It's a racialized category already. What I'm looking at, you know, in terms of what is different, you know, one of the arguments I'm making is that adolescence is starting to become a category that is not just seen as problematic, you know, by Iraqi nationalists, you know, but is a category that should be celebrated, right? This rebellious phase of life is not just a problem to be solved, it's also a type of energy to be nourished, right? So it's sort of flipping the colonial discourse almost on its head, right? Seeing adolescence as a time of tumultuous activity, but in a positive way, right? It's a period of rebellion, and we can harness that and mobilize that for the nationalist project of achieving sovereignty. And I have an article called The Stage of Adolescence. It was published a few years before the book, where I really look at this on a global level of how, you know, by the 1950s, adolescence is celebrated everywhere. You know, we get these youth movements in the US and in France and so on. But I think, you know, we need to really look at this in the context of decolonization and how adolescence and youth starts to be celebrated in the decolonizing countries as a tool for liberation. And then suddenly after World War II, it's you know, taken up by, you know, American movements and other kinds of discourses to start to celebrate adolescence. So I'm trying to really fit a lot into the answer to that question. I could also say more about the corporal punishment debate, because again, this is counterintuitive thing. The British are, you know, the Iraqi government bans corporal punishment 60 years before it's banned in Britain. You know, 1929 is when it's banned in Iraq. It's 1980 something that it's banned in Britain. And the British freak out. You know, they're complaining to the League of Nations that the Iraqi government has banned corporal punishment, debate over corporal punishment in Iraq between the British and the Iraqi officials as part of this you know, attempt on the part of Iraqi nationalists to harness the energy of adolescence in response to actual real adolescence, you know, mobilizing in protest, like you said, against the visit of Zionist leader and against some other things. So they're responding to, you know, actual the politicization and mobilization of teenagers.
It's so interesting. And I think I want to build on that to conclude my questions before we open it up for the group. And I want to conclude on this idea of, you know, engaging with adolescents in a different way. We're all, many of us are teachers, our students, many of whom are adolescents. And there's an opening that your book gives us to think really differently about the student-teacher relation, in particular in following up with this question of you know, is corporal punishment the ideal, as the colonists from Britain sort of wanted to imply? Or are there other ways of engaging with the really troublesome, troublemaking nature of these kids and youth? So to conclude on a question of pedagogy and practice, I'm wondering how your understanding of your teaching practices at NYU or elsewhere have been changed or transformed as you've researched this history. And then also, what about the book and your arguments inspires your students? I personally found the book incredibly compelling to think with and important. I look forward to teaching it. So wondering how the reception has been and what that conversation between you and your students looks like.
Okay, maybe I'll start with the last part of that. You know, I mean, it's a challenging book, honestly, for undergraduates, you know, especially, you know, I mean, it is a fairly theoretically engaged book. So, you know, I'm teaching a course in Iraq right now, a lower level, you know, large lecture course on modern Iraq. I'm not assigning the whole book, but I'm assigning several chapters of it. And the chapters I chose were the ones on these development projects. So the one that involves the U.S. Monroe Report, you know, showing up in Iraq and replicating this racialized and, you know, gendered system of education in Iraq, because students are really interested in that. You know, they tend to be super interested in that. You know, this kind of counterintuitive thing of Iraqi having an education system that was more equal on the basis of sex than the U.S. system was in the 30s is, you know, surprising to people. And also, you know, partly because of Black Lives Matter and what's going on in the U.S. the last couple of years, people are really interested in how this racialized model of education was getting exported, as you said. And then I'm also assigning the chapter on the Jujela Land Settlement Project, which is a similar thing, sort of the bringing of U.S. and other international development expertise to Iraq in ways that really reproduce, you know, uneven social formations. So I think, you know, those are the easiest ways in that I have found for students for the book are these, you know, both U.S. and global development projects and how they played out in ways that students are really surprised by and don't expect. In terms of the first part of the question, you know, it's, I mean, let me think about this. I don't know how it's changed sort of my pedagogy in the classroom, the research I did in the book. You know, I will say that it really has challenged me to sort of think critically about some of the discourses about pedagogy and education that are dominant discourses in the US and have been for a really long time. You know, the education for real life, right? The whole thing about education for real life as a way of fostering creativity, democratic forms of learning, you know, all the ways that we associate those different concepts that come from the American pragmatist school of pedagogy. The ways in which they've been used in really problematic ways around the world has, you know, I don't know if it's changed my pedagogy. I wouldn't say that necessarily, but it has made me think, you know, about how to be critical about these discourses of of constant mobility, of the anti-intellectualism, that's part of it. The anti-intellectualism in some of those discourses, because the way those ideas got implemented in Iraq was specifically to undermine the system in the 1920s that Sati al-Husri and other Iraqi Arab nationalists and other nationalists had set up, that was a much more intellectual kind of education. They didn't want to be teaching kids just manual labor. They wanted everyone to have the same education, you know, and there were problems with his thinking, obviously, if anyone knows anything about him, but he did want to implement this education system that had an intellectual content to it, because he was trying to prepare students for the struggle for sovereignty, for a nationalist movement. When the pragmatists came in, they're like, no, you can't be giving kids these intellectual types of education. You need to focus on education for real life, you know? So, and that what that ended up being was teaching girls home economics, teaching rural boys, you know, manual agricultural skills. You know, that's how these things were interpreted. And the mobility part, this pragmatist, the mobile personality, which is actually a development concept that comes out later, but the pragmatists use these concepts like the cosmopolitan child or the homeless mind. These were sort of ways, you know, they sound really good, like fostering mobility and sort of a homeless ways of thinking and cosmopolitanism. In some ways, they were about separating kids from their local environments, right? Making the, you know, attacks on memory practices, like practices of memorization that were really important in these cultures, specifically, I think, in order to separate kids from their local environments, from their local communities, in order to make them mobile in a particular way, so we can move them and settle them on this land settlement project, and then they're not supposed to move after that, definitely not to the cities to join the communist movement. So I, you know, it really has made me think more critically about discourses of mobility and in relation to modernization, I guess. I mean, I guess that would be my attempt to answer that question.
It's brilliant, Sarah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Folks, I'd like to open it up. I have more questions in case people don't, but I expect that there'll be a lot of interest. I'll go ahead and stop the screen share so we can have a sort of visual field.
Hi, everybody.
I could ask a quick question. Thank you so much for your great interview. Both of you, can you talk a little bit, maybe, Sarah, about the changing sectarianism and how that's changed over the century, being taught in schools in Iraq?
Wait, sectarianism, is that what you said?
Yeah, in schools in Iraq, how that has changed. Can you talk a little bit about that?
You mean in a particular period are you thinking about, or I'm not sure I know much about it, actually, but I could say a little bit about, say a little bit more about the...
Okay. Well, like... I mean, you're talking about how these changing gender norms and how changing racial and urban-rural divide. What about how the U.S. Came in and dealt with the idea of sectarianism within the educational system?
Okay, so the U.S. advisors that, you know, again, my story ends in 63. So, this, you know, anything after that, I'm you know, talking as a informed citizen more than anyone has done any research on it. But so the projects that I look at, you know, were American involvement in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, you know, I would say that, you know, this was one area in which sort of the Sati al-Husri people and the pragmatists were kind of in agreement. I mean, they were all against sort of sectarian forms of education. You know, they were all modernizers. They were all promoting a national education system. Sati al-Husri was different. I mean, he's often accused of sectarianism, right? For opposing Shia forms of schooling and for opposing Kurdish language kinds of schooling. So the pragmatists, including the Americans, or American and Iraqi pragmatists, they had the same ideas he did on the Shia schools. You know, they wanted to bring people into the national public schools. You know, it's just that he got called sectarian on that front and they didn't. I mean, I think Sati al-Husri was not a Sunni sectarian. He was a secular, you know, modernizer who was trying to homogenize the population with all the problems that go with that. I mean, that's what I think the critique of him should be, not a sectarian critique. So, you know, I think that was the general trajectory of these people I'm looking at on both sides of this debate over pragmatism and intellectual forms of education. I think they all agreed that sectarianism and religious forms of education were something not to be eliminated. They wanted to eliminate the particular sectarian schools and bring people into the public education system, but they did support religion as a way of inculcating morality, right? So they did actually want to expand religious education in schools, but it was a reconstruction of what was understood as religion. You know, religion was becoming associated in these modernizing sort of secular discourses with a convenient way to try to teach people morality, like these, you know, these adolescent teenage protests throughout the 30s, 40s, 50s, you know, especially once girls start getting involved in the Communist Party in the 50s, you get a lot of discourse about we need more religion in the schools. But it certainly was not we need to support Shia schools. You know, it was we need to teach religion as morality in the schools in order to inculcate proper gender roles and these kinds of things. So I don't know if that answers your question, but those are the discourses that I'm looking at, are sort of what should be the national public school curriculum in relation to these. So I, you know, within those discourses, I don't find anyone arguing that we should be teaching, you know, sectarian forms of identification.
Thanks. And would you say that that's flipped, like when the 2002 invasion and the aftermath?
I don't know actually much at all about the education system since 2003. So I would kind of be making it up. But you know, I mean, definitely there's been a, you know, sectarianization of Iraqi society. I mean, as is well known, a Shia moving to Sunni neighborhoods and vice versa, and divorces and, you know, the mixed marriages. And I mean, all of that stuff, you know, I'm sure has affected the schools, but I can't claim to actually know anything about it.
Okay, because you said like part of the justification of the invasion was to change this gender dynamics and all that. So I was wondering if you would also make the same argument about the sectarian, but that's good.
Well, I could say something about that. I mean, the gender part of that is, you know, I mean, the conflicts over the personal status law definitely, you know, came back into view after 2003 with, you know, some of the Shia, parties, you know, arguing for, you know, to annul the personal status law, which is the personal status law that was passed in 1959, which is I have a whole chapter on it in the book. And it's often considered, you know, the personal status law is often called sort of the last step in the secularization of Iraqi law, right? Supposedly bringing family law, taking family law away from religious authorities and putting it under the control of the state. One of the things I argue is the personal status law was not exactly that, because the personal status law of 1959, and it's still the one basically in place today, is, I don't know if we can call it a sectarian law, but it only applied to Muslims in Iraq. You know, it was claimed to be based on the Islamic Sharia, and it only applied to Muslims. Christians and Jews in Iraq kept their own personal status laws after 1959 with this law. You know, it's more similar. You know, we all think Lebanon is this big exception in terms of how personal status law works, and it's really not. It's just in Lebanon, there's no majority in order, you know, to call the national law. But in Iraq, it was exactly the same. I mean, the personal status laws are still based on religion or sect. It's just that one of them is called national because Muslims are a large majority. That's really the only difference. So to call this personal status law a secular law is, it is. I think it is secular in like the Talal Assad sense of the state now is the one who gets to decide what counts as religion, and religion gets privatized and, you know, moved into this realm of morality attached to the family. It is secular in that sense, but it's not secular in the sense of being anti-sectarian. Yeah. Suad.
Yeah. Sorry. First, apologies for missing the first part of your presentation. I had a computer problem I was trying to get some IT help on. So, but I was struck by your comment about the ways in which the system was educating the children for mobility, but that once it produced that outcome, it didn't want them to be mobile after. So I was wondering how is that possible? What are the mechanisms rather? What are the tools that are used for that? And the reason I'm very interested in that point is that I've long thought that there's a very close connection with the development of industrial labor force, the industrial capitalism rather, and the need for mobile labor and the development of a notion of the quote individual that is bounded and autonomous. Because in order to have a mobile labor forces, you've got to have quote individuals, that historically specific notion of the self that is bounded and autonomous, which means that it's separable. It can be moved. It perceives itself capable of movement without disrupting what the self is. That is, the self is trained to believe that it can move without that kind of disruption to selfhood. So that what the tools are for creating that kind of a potentially mobile self is varies from country to country and time to time. So I'm really curious to, if you thought, worked more closely, more deeply into that specific, the tools of creating that mobile, let me back up and ask the question a little bit different. The tools that you were looking at to create the mobile self, were they tools that were also creating a bounded autonomous self? Or do you think that they are separate, they're different phenomena?
That's a really great question. Super interesting. I think, I don't have a direct answer to the final part of the question, but I do think they're related for sure. I just think they play out differently. In Iraq, they played out differently according to class, according to location in urban or rural areas. The ways in which the education system was differentiated and these discourses about mobility and producing a mobile personality were different. And that's part of my argument, is that they weren't universal. But I do think, and I was going to actually, I was going to do this for my second book, and now I've gotten onto something else with the mandate period. I was going to look at this, that Daniel Lerner, who develops this idea of the mobile personality, right, in his book, The Passing of Traditional Society in the Middle East. Right. So specifically about how, the problem in the Middle East, I mean, it's elsewhere, but Middle East is what he's focusing on, is that people haven't learned how to be mobile. Right. They're not mobile in this modern way. It's really interesting to talk about, Middle East historically is not being mobile. We're talking about this society where there's a lot of nomads, there's a lot of mobility, people are moving around like a lot. And so it's really interesting to think about the kind of mobility that's starting to be valued in these 1950s development discourses. It's not that, it's not the capacity to move around, it's something else. And I think you really, identified a really important part of it,
which is the creation
of this bounded self, right? This bounded discrete self.
They don't want tribal mobility. They want individual mobility. They want the person to be dislocated, not the whole community.
Yes. And I also think they want, and it's for purposes of labor, I would agree with you on that. And I think that's really important in what I look at in terms of these land settlement projects, right? It's trying to mobilize people, to do certain kinds of work without mobilizing them, without creating dangerous mobilities of political, political mobilization and capacities. I mean, it was all about trying to free them from their stasis, from their attachments to local communities and their relatedness and to community, which enhanced political mobilization in a way like the British and Americans didn't like. But how to do that without creating new mobilities, like in schools where now youth are organizing in these horizontal ways along age identifications. That wasn't the plan, right, of schooling. It wasn't to create new kinds of political capacities, but that's what it did everywhere. All these youth movements in the 40s, 50s, 60s. So I think it's constantly about trying to create this capitalist kind of mobility of bodies for purposes of labor, and then managing the other mobilities that get created as side effects of that. I think that's really what I'm looking at.
The interesting thing, if you look back at the earlier Ba'ath period in the 70s, as they were trying to use all the oil revenues to create infrastructure, building roads, building schools, increasing literacy, building industries, they needed more of a labor force than they had. And the immediately available labor force that was there for them to mobilize was women. So in fact, the Ba'ath under Saddam Hussein created an awful lot of infrastructure to make it possible to free women up from their families in order to get them into the labor force, including free childcare, access to housing that was under the women, literacy training that was mandated for the women. They set up the Iraq, General Federation of Iraqi Women had something like 2,000 cells all over the country that was specifically intended to eradicate illiteracy among women in order to mobilize them into the wage labor force. Of course, later they started bringing in workers from outside of the country, and especially after the Iran-Iraq war, which devastated the infrastructure, they reverted back on a lot of the reforms that they had made in the early 70s. So the trick there is really interesting, which is exactly the way you present it. How do you create the kind of self, I'm interested in the creation of selfhood, which is what you're writing about here. How is it you create that self that can be mobile as labor, but not independent politically?
Exactly. Exactly. And even that, the example of the Baathist, the General Federation of Women, I mean, they're coming out, you know, they're modeling, you know, that whole organization on this Communist League for Defense of Women's Rights that I look at in the 50s. It was, you know, yes. a really active feminist organization in Iraq, which had literacy programs. Actually, I have this chapter on a controversy over their literacy program in the after the 58 revolution. The Communist Women's League starts sending women into rural areas, teaching women literacy. And they claim they're just teaching them literacy and home economics, but no one believes them. You know, they're communists going into rural areas to teach women. And so the Baathists, you know, were trying to, you know, get a hold of this very popular, you know, model for organized, for women organizing, but in that for a completely different purpose. I mean, the communist women had, you know, there's issues with them too. We could criticize them for certain things also. But I think the Baathist model is really trying to take that, but in this disciplined way. So again, it's trying to manage certain mobilities, you know, without the consequences of them.
Yeah. And back to tie it into your point about the family, about personal status laws. In the early 70s, the Baath were also manipulating personal status laws in order to free women up. And they set up courts for divorce and reconciling marital problems. And they would not allow divorce to happen without reference to these courts, which were run by the General Federation of Iraqi Women. So it's really fascinating the way they're playing with personal status laws as well. Again, I think at that time, in the interest of freeing, it was an anti-tribal movement. They were trying to break up the tribes. Mm-hmm. And the easiest way, or at least the way that the strategy they were using was to free women up from the control of the tribe. And so the labor laws, the fact that women could get access to education, the fact that they housing could be put in a woman's name if she was the main worker of the family. They had daycare centers set up attached to all of these new factories. They would give women, they had, women could take time off from work to nurse their babies if they were in these daycare centers. All of that at the time I thought was about free, it was an anti-tribal, it was not feminism, it wasn't even state feminism, it was about breaking up the big tribes and freeing, and one way to break up those tribes was to free the women up from tribal control. So it's interesting, it fits into the larger picture you're painting there.
No, it does. And the 19, you know, I mean, the personal status law, which was originally passed in 1959, you know, after the Baath coup of 63, you know, one of the first things they do, I mean, after they slaughter all the communists, is they change that law, the personal status law. I mean, it's one of the first things they do. And a lot of historians have seen it as one of the factors behind the first Baath coup of 63 was the coalition they managed to put together of Sunni and Shia religious authorities with Arab nationalists against the personal status law. But it was not against the whole law, actually. This is one of the things I said, once I started exploring it, it was just against the equal inheritance clause of the law. The Baathists liked the law other than that for the reasons that you say. You know, it was promoting this nuclear family against larger extended family ties, tribal ties. You know, they were fine with the law except for that one clause, equal inheritance clause. Yeah.
Thank you.
That's a question. Thank you so much, Sarah. That was great. I had a question about the state and field of youth politics in Iraq in your period in the 1940s and 50s. The interview there, I think, did an excellent job of sort of showing these discourses around child innocence or you know, this ageless childhood, the things you were talking about, adolescence as a colonial category. But you also hinted to in the beginning with that picture of that child, that children as demonstrators. You mentioned in the context of, I think Tori mentioned this in 58, how many women were out, and I'm guessing you know, a sizable population of that were defined as young women, however you define that, by age, by class, however it may be. So it's clear that there is sort of a field of youth politics in 1950s Iraq. So I was wondering if you could just speak a little bit, of course, we can't divorce the field of youth politics from the design to control youth or to control young people. And I think you did a great job of sort of balancing that, but children and youth as agents in the 58 revolution. Wondering if you could speak a little bit about that.
I guess I just got a little stuck by, so it seems like you, not in terms of the sort of, well, rephrase, can you say a little bit more?
Yeah. So I think discursively in terms of how youth and children were molded, have a great sense of that. I know you alluded to in the beginning, you know, this sort of image of a child as sort of a political actor this moment. So just, and obviously the stat that Tori brought up as well in terms of how many women were out in 58, even if that's qualified, just sort of like the real presence of children and youth in 58. What do you know about that? Is there any way archivally that you have resurrected that, whatever, or reconstructed that, whatever that may be?
It was common, certainly common understanding in Iraq that many of the people involved in protests were extremely young. High school students were very politically active. I interviewed some communist women who were leaders of the women's wing of the Communist Party, in 58, and they were like 18 or 19 then, and they actually joined the Communist Party while they were in high school. A lot of them got politicized in high school and joined, this totally underground, secret, really dangerous thing to join while they were in high school. So there's no question that, if you read Hanna Battatu's book in Iraq, he says the high schools were like, and the colleges were like the center of the Communist Party, which was the most popular party in Iraq at this time. So I think it's pretty well known that the students were super involved politically. The degree to which it went beyond students, I think it's really hard to tell. I don't know of any work on that, and I didn't do any archival, sort of empirical work on that of trying to identify like non-student youth populations involved in the protests. In the protests, you hear there's lots of discourse about people, from the slums around Baghdad joining the protests, and there was fears about them joining the Communist Party and getting mobilized by communists, which they were to some extent. How much of them were young? I don't know if anyone knows or has done research on that. But for sure, the students, this was the problem for the government all through the 30s, 40s, and 50s, is that the students were just producing, leftists. that was the fear, and that was the reality too.
Thank you.
Yeah. And it was, the reality that was predicted by, the Americans who said, oh, you can't be doing this intellectual kind of education. The British were saying the same thing. All the warnings were about that. Like, you need to be careful bringing people together into the school, in this really fraught political and socioeconomic context of Iraqi society, because, first there's not going to be jobs for them, and you're just going to end up with a bunch of, educated radicals without jobs. That was the warning all through the decades, not just in Iraq, but around the world. Mm-hmm. There's a reason for those warnings, but the government also needed to educate people. So this was a constant, I think it was just partly what Suad and I were just talking about. It's a constant balancing act, or acting and reacting to try to control the forces that have been unleashed by some of these processes. And just the fact is axis along which people are organizing, it's often attributed to the schools, and that's a big part of it. That's where people learn that they are the same age and start to identify with each other as the same age, and they start having the same experiences because they've gone through the schools together. This is what creates some of those horizontal affiliations. I do also look at, though, I think there are generational intra-generational alliances that kind of went beyond that because of the importance of extended families in Iraq. So, people organizing through their brothers and sisters and cousins. When I interviewed people, it was usually that. Yeah, I got politicized by my brother, or my cousin got into the Communist Party first. So I think there are these age identifications too that were intergenerational, across like extended family bonds. And I don't go into that in detail or do a lot of research on it, but I discuss how that keeps coming up in the interviews. So I think age-related, affiliations are not just through the schools. Yeah. They can also be through certain kinds of family social ties.
Great point. Thank you.
I have a quick follow-up if folks don't have other questions, but I'd also like to ask those who haven't spoken yet if there's questions for Sarah. While you're thinking, Sarah, as you were speaking about this sort of age categorization, it reminded me of your chapter on time and the difference between wasted time and revolutionary time. And wondering, as we start to think about wrapping up, if we can go back to the differences between cyclical and progressive, but you also locate yourself in the middle of those differences. And you look at time as maybe something that's made. At least that's how I was reading your work. So in particular, in this question of how these youth are organizing across peer groups and transgenerationally, how is time being reworked?
So, I mean, one thing I would say is, you know, these youth involved in these leftist movements, I mean, the communist movement especially, you know, they, and are really important in the 58 revolution, you know, they are very much embedded in, you know, the linear modernization narrative, you know, the communist version of that, right? The two-stage revolution and all of that. So I think, you know, they are really, in that sense, part of this larger discourse that I'm critical of, the linear modernization narrative that is very gendered, right? So sort of male linear time and then feminine cyclical time and the ways in which those come together in these modernization discourses to kind of try to stabilize, I think, some of the instabilities that we've been talking about of political mobilization. So they're both, you know, they're oppositional, and certainly the state sees them as a big threat, but in some ways they also have this very hegemonic idea of historical time, at least many of them do. And I think that's one reason after the revolution, they are so willing to just give their complete trust over to this, you know, military government, even though technically the Communist Party is calling for a democratic government and a brief transition from military rule, but they are so attached to this linear idea of the two-stage revolution, the first stage being the capitalist bourgeois revolution, that they end up being just really not non-critical of the state that comes into being in 1958. So, I mean, that is my, you know, one of my criticisms of this idea of time is the ways in which it can just really easily become an argument for deferral, right? It's supposed to be about change and about progress, but it ends up often being about deferral. Okay, now we're in the with a capitalist bourgeois revolution, so we have to give up all our power to this military government because they're the historically necessary agent to carry out the capitalist revolution. We have to tell workers who are having strikes and other kinds of worker protests that we are now in the period of suspending class struggle, right? Because that's not the stage we're in. So they're actually, you know, this ridiculous situation of communists telling, you know, workers to stop striking because that's not the historical stage that we're in. So I think time is made. I mean, I think these ideas about time are really important for how people act in the world, and they have, you know, really important effects. At the same time, I'm also really interested in the book in, you know, the ways in which many Iraqi intellectuals were thinking about different ideas of time. I mean, Jawad Salim is one of them in that monument. Ali al-Wardi is another one, the Iraqi sociologist. You know, they're trying to think about other ways of time that I think do not end in this static sort of point of deferral, partly by drawing on like Ibn Khaldun in creative ways and then thinking about perpetual revolution or, you know, as soon as a revolution happens, you know, you have to actually oppose the current state that has initiated the revolution, because as al-Wardi said, success is the grave of revolution. Once a revolution happens, the revolution's over and you have to start working on the next one, right? So he was drawing on Ibn Khaldun to actually sort of counter, I think, some of these problematic aspects of the linear modernization narrative by saying, you know, we have to keep struggling, you know, even more so after the revolution, because then, you know, there is no revolution once a new government has taken power. So I'm trying to really engage with Iraqi intellectuals who are thinking about these things, about time, cyclicality, and linearity, and kind of, you know, I learned a lot from reading these intellectuals. So, and that this was not a part of the book that I had planned in the beginning. It's just they were saying really interesting things that I think were helping me think about other ways of imagining political mobilization and political capacities besides the linear narratives, whether they're coming from the left or the right.
Sarah, I don't know if you've been following the debate in the American Historical Review about the history of childhood. It's going on since October, and so these prominent historians came out and said that yes, age is a useful category of analysis. And then there was a big rebuttal from someone named Sarah Maza, who said, made a very sort of controversial article that said that no, children are not all right. It's not a useful field of analysis in history. They don't produce enough sources. They have limited voices, that have limited agency. They outgrow their subaltern status. So it's a really big debate about whether or not children should be the focus of historical analysis. Now, I know that you don't identify as a historian of childhood, but I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on making history, making children the focus of a historical analysis, like what you think of that and the possibilities in that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not familiar with the debate at all, so I don't want to take a particular position on the debate that's going on. But I mean, I teach a class on youth and youth movements in the Middle East, and we look at some of the earlier debates that are similar to that, or at least sound similar to that. You know, I think, I mean, I use childhood and youth as categories. I use generation as a category. I do think, you know, there's generational kinds of change and generational kinds of sensibilities that are important or useful to look at. I definitely do that in the course that I teach on youth and youth movements in the Middle East. And thinking about political generations too, I think is really important, maybe especially for the Middle East for some reason. I mean, there, you know, political generations is a thing. I would say, you know, when I teach the course on youth and youth movements, you know, when I bring in sort of scholars critiquing the uses of youth, it's more along the lines of the ways in which particular movements like the Arab Spring get imagined as a youth movement can be problematic, right? Because it can be a way of ignoring their own socioeconomic demands, their own class positions, you know, it can be a way of ignoring class in particular. So that's my only, I mean, that would be the only critique that I can come up with in terms of the way I've seen youth being used as a category or generations being used as a category. I think it's a little different from what you're asking because it's more about childhood. Yeah, I don't know why. I don't know why childhood wouldn't be a legitimate field of study. But.
Thank you, Nizan, for sharing the name and the link of that debate for folks that are interested in following and seeing.
Yeah, and I'm super interested. Yeah, I'll look at that, especially for the class I teach on this, some of these questions. I'm really working more on, you know, I mean, in terms of, you know, empirically, you know, my stuff on childhood is more about sort of the discourse of childhood now it's being used, and also the education system and how children are targeted in sort of gendered ways in the education system. In terms of these questions about mobilization, it's, you know, I'm really focused more on youth and adolescence. So I don't know that I study, you know, childhood as a historical empirical category that much.
Can I jump in? Okay. So I wonder, like, rather than childhood, like how motherhood is playing a role in constructing this future, like the discourse on future or like raising kids. You mentioned the home economics class, but I don't know, like, how much it was related to childcare or child raising, or was it like more about like economics on home or like, you know, like home economics, whatever that. I wonder, like, can you, so like how to what extent it was about like childcare, child raising. So like when I say child raising, it's also like mother, like mother's role in building this discourse on future or the futuristic discourse. I don't know whether it makes sense what I said.
I think so, yeah. I mean, I actually started out on sort of the motherhood angle because it was really starting out as, you know, a gender history. So I was really, in the very beginning, I was looking at, I mean, first I was looking at women in the Communist Party, and then I was looking at this personal status law. You know, this was the trajectory of my dissertation. And thinking about, you know, modern feminine domesticity, you know, my advisor was Beth Barron. So coming out of that whole, you know, field of scholarship. So it really started there. I was looking at women and ideas about motherhood and domesticity. One way I got into the questions of more of childhood and child raising and youth was, you know, especially I think in the 1950s, I mean, it's probably true in the earlier period too. There hadn't been a lot of work in the 1950s on gender history, you know, when I started. There's still not tons, you know. And so this whole economic development frame really changed things. You know, the families being targeted were lower class families. They weren't middle class bourgeois families, right? The family interventions that I was looking at were really about lower class laboring families, both rural and urban. I started to think that, you know, this idea that you hear in some of the sort of feminist scholarship that feminine domesticity or the new focus on motherhood was sort of a way to get women in the home or keep them in the home. Or I actually was taking the discourses more seriously. I think they actually were about childhood and how children are raised. I mean, I think that was a really important part of it, is the state and development agencies really being concerned with how children could be raised to be you know, productive laborers, for example, without being political activists, like Suad and I were talking about. So I think, you know, it was not just a fake thing to get women into the home. It was a genuine concern with how children are raised. So that sort of was my transition into some questions about childhood and youth was precisely that. Does that answer your question, kind of?
Yeah.
Anyone else?
Just kind of a wrap up question if there's no more sort of bigger questions. Sarah, you alluded to future work. Can you give us a little teaser? What's next for you?
Yeah, it's not super related to any of this so far, but yeah, I was originally, for a long time, the plan of my second book was basically an expansion of the chapter of the first book on the land settlement project I mentioned, the Djela land settlement project, which was a social and ecological disaster because of this certain commitment to the idea of family farming. Which, yeah, I'm not going to say more about that right now, but it has actually totally changed because I think because the chapter that's bugging me about the current book about familiar futures, the chapter that's bugging me is the first chapter about the British Mandate period. Because I sort of meant to write this chapter that was like kind of historical background for the rest of the book. Like, oh, I'll just write a chapter in the mandate to sort of set up some of these questions. That was probably a mistake because I ended up just getting frustrated with the secondary literature. It was just going to be based in secondary literature, right? But I ended up getting frustrated with secondary literature. So I did some of my own research, but I didn't have time to do a lot of research. So now, you know, I do make some arguments that I think, you know, they're important for me anyways about the British Mandate. But I still have a lot of questions about it. So I'm really writing a book about the formation of Iraq and the rebellions around from 1914 to 1920, the anti-colonial rebellions, and then thinking about the way the British, the sort of architecture of the British legal system, largely in response to those rebellions. And it does involve personal status law, because one of the things they did already in 1917, the British were intervening in Ottoman personal status law, which I didn't even know until fairly recently, actually. And one of the things they're doing is trying to bring, I'm arguing, the Shia clerical class, which is a very rebellious class, you know, really involved in the 1920 revolt, for example, trying to bring it into the state apparatus through the reform of Shia personal status law and creating this whole system of official, you know, Jafari Shia personal status courts under the control of the British Mandate states. And the British are appointing the clerics, you know, the judges to those courts. So it is partly about family again and about reform of religion as morality and sort of the privatization of religion. I don't know how much it will have to do with, you know, the questions of childhood and youth that I started to get into in the first book, but that's where I'm going right now with it.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that Beth Barron, who's on our board, regrets that she wasn't able to attend today.
Oh, that would have been fun to see her. I like the kids.
If I can ask.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hello.
No.
Okay.
What time do you guys usually go to? Is it 1:30? I didn't even look.
Just whenever Tori wants to call, whenever we want to call Tori. Well, it sounded like maybe you had one more thought or question.
I mean, I did, Sarah, just because of, you know, we didn't talk much about the British Mandate, and there is a question about sex non-differentiation within the necropolitical bombing that I was interested in returning to because of today's bombing in Iraq, and the ongoing question of warfare in the region. And so your return almost to the British Mandate and how Iraq was formed seems essential right now. So maybe for me to conclude the thinking, to go back to that question of how and why the British decided to use aerial bombing in such a way that did not differentiate between gender categories in the way that we might expect.
Yeah, no, thank you. It is a good actually to sort of end on this, I think. Yeah, so one of the things I look at in that chapter is how the British, you know, the British, I mean, this has been written about by many scholars, but the use of Iraq as a as the laboratory for the first large scale experiment and rule from the air, right? Can we rule a colony from the air rather than with ground troops? So obviously this is the beginning of a really important long-term process of changes in, you know, imperial forms of power that, but you're right, of course, that, you know, we see, you know, this is the dominant way now of intervening in other places. You know, in terms of the sexual non-difference, so one of the things the British argued is we can no longer count casualties in terms of these categories we used to use of men, women, and children. And the reason they gave for it is, the real reason was just they couldn't see the people they were bombing. I mean, they couldn't tell who was who, and so they literally couldn't do it. But what they said, they blamed Iraqis for not being sexually differentiated enough. They're like, we can't tell the men from the women anyways. So there's no point in putting them in these separate casualty categories. Of course they couldn't tell them, you know, they were, you know, however many feet up in the air when they were bombing them. So, you know, I'm looking at this sort of shift, I think, from more kind of biopolitical disciplinary forms of colonial power to this rule from the air, which is too far away to be biopolitical, for one, and it's just the direct application of violence on people's bodies. So it's not the same thing as what, you know, people write about with, say, India or Egypt, of these, you know, biopolitical interventions that are really interested in things like family and gender. The British weren't interested, really. They weren't very interested in those things in Iraq because they were doing this other thing of rule from the air. So, you know, I think, you know, it is certainly relevant to how what I would call imperial forms of power work today. And I think it, you know, it hasn't really been theorized enough. You know, we're still often sort of stuck on, I think, older models of imagining how colonial power worked or works. And this is why, you know, one of the reasons I think that scholarship on some of these questions, you know, sort of the colonial modernity questions, the gender scholarship, the biopolitics and discipline, all these really, really interesting works we have in Middle East history in those, you know, from those analytical perspectives, they basically stop with World War II. You know, we don't have a lot of them for the post-World War II period, because I think we don't have ways of thinking about these new forms of power like air power. I mean, something, there is some interesting work on it, but I think, you know, it's really minimal compared to this amazing work we have on like the interwar period or the, you know, early 20th century. So part that is part of my interest in the mandate too, is sort of the beginning of all of that, of how to build a legal system that will, you know, allow us to rule when our main, you know, punitive method is air power, and how can we construct a legal system that works with that.
One of the most, I think, shocking parts of that part of the chapter was Gertrude Bell, who we imagine as kind of being this benevolent, I don't know why I imagine her being more benevolent than the officials, but her looking at one of these bombing campaigns and talking about how wondrous and horrifying it is, right? It's this like, it's almost Kantian in the sublime sense of like how this air power was used to advance, yeah, something. So really looking forward to that.
Yeah, addition. No, and she, you know, she's watching this demonstration and she is awed by it because it's this incredible technology, but it's chilling now because she's describing this really violent kind of warfare. But I remember the same thing. I mean, specifically, I remember in 1991 when the US was invading Iraq in 91 and, you know, CNN commentators being like, it looks like fireworks, like just being blown away with the visual, you know, the visuals of this, you know, technology. So, yeah.
You were
shocking all.
For questioning those logics. So thank you. And we're looking forward to reading more and discussing more. And everyone, thank you for your attendance.
Thank you for the really, really great questions and for inviting me. Yeah, I have a lot to think about from the questions today.
Yeah, I just, thank you so much, Sarah. I wanted to plug real quick for those here that don't know, our next Digital Speakers Series event will be Friday, March 26th. We'll send out emails about it. Same time, it's going to be with Dr. Majid Hanoum and his book, Living Tangier, Migration, Race, and Illegality in a Moroccan City, published with the University of Pennsylvania Press in 2020. So that should be fun. I think, Heidi, you're doing that interview, right? If my records serve me. Okay, great. So I'm going to turn off the recording now.